Coming to you from New York City, it's the Friars Club Podcast. Established in 1904, the Friars Club is the birthplace of the celebrity roast and has counted the likes of Frank Sinatra, Jimmy Fallon, Billy Crystal, Barbara Streisand, and Johnny Carson among its members. So come on in for a drink and some laughs with your host, Joe Sibilia.
Hello and welcome to the Friars Club podcast. This is your host, Joe Sibilia, and joining me today is somebody who I have been aware of for many years. About a year ago, I was looking for a good book to read, and lo and behold, I find this brand new book called Get Mahoney, A Hollywood Insider's Memoir, and it's written by my guest today, Jim Mahoney. He was the publicist for so many of the great stars of the golden age of Hollywood, many of whom were members of the Friars Club. Some of them include Frank Sinatra, Johnny Carson, Steve McQueen, Debbie Reynolds, Bob Newhart, Peggy Lee, Christie Brinkley, James Garner, and so many others, and we're going to get into all this with him. Jim, thank you so much for joining me on the Friars Club podcast. How are you?
It's fun to be here. Thank you.
Now, your father, he was a house painter, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Right. Yeah.
So your father set up a meeting for you one day, and he said, you're coming to work with me, and you were a little hesitant, you might say, to go, or you didn't necessarily want to go that day, but you decided you'll go with your father. And what happens when you arrive on the job site that day?
My dad was a very successful interior decorator, and his customers ranged from film directors to movie stars and all that kind of stuff in the entertainment industry. I'd been kicked out of four high schools and graduated from Santa Monica City College, and then entered USC. And I was a senior at USC when, on this particular Sunday morning, my dad asked me what I planned to do that day. And I told him I was going to the beach. He said, no, I'd like you to come with me. I just finished a house that I'm very proud of, and I think you'd get a kick out of seeing who lives there. And we drove out to Encino, which was an hour's drive in those days from Beverly Hills or Culver City, where we lived. And we got to the parking area, and there were half a dozen cars, dream cars. It was shortly after the war, and there weren't that many good-looking cars around. But in the garage, there was a new Jag and a new Cadillac convertible, a limousine, a Woody, if you remember what they were.
Oh, sure, with the wood body.
I was fascinated, to say the least, and my dad said, come on, let's go into that. I want you to see the house. And we walked up, and as we got closer to the house, we passed a pool, and there were a couple of guys having brunch by the pool, and he said, come here, I want you to meet somebody. And he takes me by the hand, and he introduces me to a fellow by the name of Howard Strickling, who turned out to be Louis B. Mayer's right-hand man, and he was one of the original fixers, if you're familiar with that terminology, for people that could evade problems and avoid problems. And he was having brunch with a fellow by the name of Clark Gable. And I certainly knew who he was. And Gable and my dad went in the house to discuss business with the house, and came back about 45 minutes later, and Strickling said, I had a nice chat with your son, Howard, and I told him when he gets out of school, if he'd like to come out to the studio, I'll see if I can find a spot for him in my department. And his publicity department was probably the most important in the industry at that point in time. He had 30-some-odd people on a contract, and all of them pretty big names. And with that, Gable says, well, if he goes to work for you, Howard, I want him to handle me. And that's how I started in the business. My first client was Clark Gable. And I learned from the ground up. And it was a lot of fun. And, you know, 80 years later, here we are.
And it's incredible to think that you go so far back that you're working with Clark Gable. Now, Did you at all find Clark Gable to be demanding, as many stars of that era would be, or was he very down to earth with you? Did you see him almost like, you know, like a mentor in those days?
He was one hell of a guy, and he was my mentor, so to speak, you know, and he wasn't a tough sell, but he really was a good guy, and Strickling took me under his wing, and I guess, you know, it was like graduate school and in PR, marketing, and to this day, I just, you know, can't believe how lucky I've been.
Please correct me if I'm mistaken, but it was through Ava Gardner, when you were working for MGM, that you first met her husband and your future client, Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
So what happened on that first meeting with Frank Sinatra at their house?
Yeah, well, one of my jobs is to greet our big stars when they were coming home from abroad or wherever, and take them to the airport and see them off. There's a picture in the book of me taking Ava to the airport. She was flying to Africa to make Mogambo. But the first time I met Sinatra, the driver, we went to her house up in the Hollywood Hills, and I got out, and as I was walking up to the house, she appeared in a window on the second floor and said, "Jimmy, I'll be down in a minute. We can go in and mix yourself a drink, and I'll be right down." And I went into the house and into the living room area and the bar area, and was on my way to the bar, and out of nowhere, I hear this voice, "Who the fuck are you?" And I turn around. There, sitting in the corner, is Frank Sinatra. And that was my first. And I'm sure he never remembered. He might have, and I don't know if I ever asked him if he remembered. But that was the start of a 15-year relationship. I left the studio and went to work for a columnist by the name of Harrison Carroll, who was syndicated in Hearst papers. And I went to work for him as his leg man. And as it happened, he came seriously ill, and I was stuck writing the column for about 3 months. And I got to know a hell of a lot of people in that period of time. And as you well know, people like to see their name in the paper. And so I was welcome almost everywhere. And I don't think I ever picked up a tab that entire time.
So now, when you were doing the nightclub beat, you used to go to all of the big openings of the big acts. And who were your favorite acts to go and see? I know you got to see Don Rickles very early in his career performing when you were working for Harrison Carroll.
I was working for the paper, and occasionally have dinner with an old friend who was a press agent. And we were having dinner one evening, and he said, "I want you to do me a favor. I've got a new client. He's opening." It was a small place. It wasn't like the Macombo or Cyril's or Coconut Grove. It was a small bistro. And I said, "I don't want to go." He said, "Do me a favor, will you please? The guy is, he's just opening, and he's going to be a good client, I think. He's funny as hell." And he says, "Just please go see him." And so I went to the restaurant, and they put me at a table down front, right in front, around almost, it was on the stage, right, you know, and all of a sudden, da 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 dee da da dee da 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 dee da da dee da 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 dee da 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 do do da 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 dee da, and that was his opening music. That almost as perfect as he would have done it. The band would have done it, rather than the orchestra. And then he walks to the center stage, and I'm sitting down right in front of him, and I got my feet up on the stage, and I'm pushed the chair back so that I could look up, and he said, "Are you in show business?" And I said, no. He said, then get your fucking foot off the stage. That was my introduction to Rickles, and we became fast friends, and that went on for years. He was really a funny guy. God.
And it's amazing to think that Don Rickles and Bob Newhart, probably two of the most disparate comedians you could think of, wound up being best friends, and both of which were involved with the Friars Club, of course.
Oh, Newhart, yeah. But I'll tell you, one of the guys that was really brilliant was Jonathan Winters.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I couldn't stay in the same room with him, literally. My jaw would freeze up from laughing so hard. But we had many a good time over the years.
How did you get to know Jonathan Winters?
When I was writing the column, I'd go to nightclubs every night, or dinner clubs like Ciro's and Macambo. And every night I'd go to one, or if there was an opening in Las Vegas, I'd go up for that. So I met everybody. I mean, I literally in 2 or 3 years that I was doing that column, I met virtually everybody in the business that meant anything, that would make news, you know.
How did you go from working with Harrison Carroll on the column as his leg man to breaking off and becoming the publicist for Frank Sinatra?
Well, I got to know Frank quite well over that period in time, because I would go to all of his openings in Vegas, and occasionally I'd run into him accidentally. On one occasion, my wife and I, we were out, and he asked us to join him at the Villa Capri. We were sitting at the bar, and he come over and asked us to join him for dinner. And during the course of dinner, he said to me that he'd like me to come to the studio tomorrow, and I want to talk to you about something. So I went to the studio, and he said to me, how long are you going to stay in that hokey business? And I said, until something better comes along. And he said, well, it just did. I want you to handle me. And I said, but you already got a PR agency. He said, I want you to do it. So that's how I started with him. I went to work for Rogers and Cowan. It was a big PR agency. And my first assignment was handling Frank Sinatra. And it went on from there. 15 years later.
When you represented Frank Sinatra, he was sort of coming back from the doldrums of his career. I guess he had just won the Oscar for From Here to Eternity when you started with him, and you were representing him during the Rat Pack years, at the height of that. What relationship did the five members of the Rat Pack have, that being Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis, Peter Lawford, Joey Bishop? Were they close off stage as well as on stage, in your estimation?
Yes.
What do you remember about their camaraderie, and what do you remember about that time when they were doing those shows in Las Vegas? And were you there for any of those original Rat Pack performances back in 1960?
I was there for all of them. I represented all of them, not as a group, but I represented Dean, I represented Frank, I represented Joey Bishop, and subsequently, Sammy Davis.
Does the myth live up to the hype from the reality that you were at when you were there in the showroom at the Sands?
Ironically, I thought about this a lot. I'm representing the most important group in the business at the time, and I never paid any attention to them on stage. If I was representing them in Vegas, I've seen the show. I've seen the show many, many times, all of them. And I'd leave the showroom and go to a roulette wheel and spend an hour losing my money. The biggest act in the business at the time, and I'd seen it so many times that there's something else to do. Doesn't sound very good, but I represented a lot of people, and you know, Judy Garland and Peggy Lee, and you know, other singers, Vic Damone and Tony Bennett, and it goes on and on. I had a hell of a career. It was fun.
Do you remember being at the Rat Pack show that took place in St. Louis?
I was there.
Yeah. So what do you remember about that show? Because that's a famous one because it was preserved on film. And of course, Frank and Dean and Sammy were there, but Joey Bishop had hurt his back and Johnny Carson was filling in for him.
I should explain right from the outset that I was a last minute substitution tonight. And I hope you're not too disappointed. Mr. Joey Bishop was supposed to be... Joy injured his back and was not able to make it, and Frank called me, and I was delighted to come out here for this cause, because I believe in it. Actually, what happened, Joy slipped a disc backing out in Frank's presence. You didn't know that's the way you leave a room when Frank... Oh, yes, you... My liege, may I leave? Then you back out of the room.
What do you remember about that time in St. Louis with them?
It was just another show, you know. There was a priest by the Dismas was his name, I think. And
The charity was Dismas House.
Yeah, and it was a place where criminals went to after they were released. I don't know a hell of a lot more about it other than that. And I never got involved with it. And it was just a one-night deal. But it was quite impressive. Tickets were sold in theaters to see it live, I think, on television, if I remember.
They did a closed-circuit transmission of it to different, I think, movie theaters across the country. So, yes, people could watch it. Let me ask you this. It's been well-documented that Frank Sinatra had his falling out with Peter Lawford, who you also worked with and represented. How did that impact your relationship with Peter Lawford? When Frank fell out with Peter, did he expect you to disassociate from him entirely?
Lawford was a client of mine as well. And there's an interesting section of the book on my relationship with Lawford and John F. Kennedy.
Kennedy wanted you on his press team.
He wanted me to give up my business and go to work for him.
Now, what was some of the advice that you had offered the Kennedy campaign? I thought it was interesting. I read in your book that you didn't feel that Kennedy's appearance with the Rat Pack in Las Vegas was particularly well thought out on Kennedy's part. Why was that? Why did you think that that wasn't necessarily the best move for the...
I give you an example of Bob Hope was a client of mine, and he did a show like once a month for NBC, and the sponsor was Chrysler. And so... I've forgotten the name of Hope's manager, but he went to Hope and said, we're doing a show in 2 weeks and we don't have anything. Who do you want on the show? Do you have anybody you want to do the show with? And he'd usually have two or three guests on an hour-long Chrysler special, Bob Hope.
Right.
And so the manager suggested, why don't we just bring on Frank Sinatra and the two of you do an hour and that'll be the show. And whomever it was, I mean, Hope said, sounded good to him. And so they made a deal with Sinatra's guy, Hank Santacola, and they were going to pay Frank, I think, $50,000 for the show one night. And they agreed to the deal and they're preparing for the show in a couple of weeks, and they didn't have to cast it. It was going to be Sinatra who agreed to do it. And word got back to Hope. from the sponsor, Chrysler, that they didn't want Sinatra hosting a show under their name. It was the wrong image they had. Word got back to Sinatra that Chrysler didn't want him hosting their shows. And Sinatra said, that's okay. He said to his agent, he said, what were they going to pay me? And he said, $50,000. He said, get the check and give it to charity. $50,000 in those days was a lot of money, believe me.
It's a lot of money to me today. You know what rent is in New York now, Jim?
Needless to say, people wondered, you know, what's Frank's relationship with Hope? And it was never the same. It was never as it should have been.
One more thing about Frank I want to ask you. You opened the book with a rather riveting opening, which is the kidnapping of Frank Sinatra Jr. What do you remember about that period of time where Frank Sinatra Jr. was taken? And were you confident that they were going to recover Frank Jr. alive?
No.
Or no. What was your feeling about
that? No idea. As a matter of fact, I was sitting with Sinatra in his room in the suite at the Mapes Hotel in Reno. The first night the kid was kidnapped, and the FBI guys, J. Edgar Hoover guys, were all over the case and did a hell of a job, by the way. But we were sitting listening to the news, and one of the detectives or FBI guys or something was quoted as saying that the first 8 hours are the most critical, and we passed that 8 hours, and it doesn't look good. And in effect, what he was saying was the kid's going to be killed. And when Frank heard this guy say that, he said, bullshit. Nobody's going to kill my kid, you know. And he got lucky. The kidnappers were good at what they did, but they were also inept in so many ways.
And then you got into an interesting predicament, I know, at one point, because you were manning the phones and two calls came in.
I was in the living room of the suite where we were staying, and Sinatra was in the bedroom area. And the first call came in, and it was J. Edgar Hoover. And I said, he's unavailable at the moment, if you can hang on for a second. And the secretary said, I'll put you on hold. And so I went to tell Frank that J. Edgar Hoover was on the phone. And I got near his suite, and phone rang again. And I went back and I said, who's calling? And the guy says, Momo. He'll know who it is. Just tell him it's Momo. And I explained to him, I said, I've got him on hold. I'll be right back. And so I went in to Sinatra, and I told him, you got two phone calls. One's J. Edgar Hoover, and the other one's a fellow by the name of Momo. I said, which one do you want to take? And he said, I'll take Momo. Tell Hoover I'll call him back. And that's how it went. Momo was and I've got to thinking, and I told Frank later, I said, Jesus, Frank, we've got the bad guys and the good guys working the case.
I want to ask you, because so many of these people we've been talking about are all members of the Friars Club, and that's a big reason why I want to have you on the show. You work with so many of these people who are in the Friars Club. Perhaps my favorite chapter of the book, Jim, might have been the chapter where you talk about all of the different talk show hosts you worked with, one of which was a member of the Friars and a member of the Rat Pack, and that was Joey Bishop. You worked on his talk show. What do you remember about working on Joey's talk show?
He didn't fit. I mean, he was not it was like Carson. When the lights went on, he was Johnny Carson and funny and a great deal of fun. Bishop was the same. He wasn't always a funny guy. And he wasn't any fun to be around privately for any length of time.
Let's talk about Carson. So you end up working with Johnny Carson. This was, I guess, in the 1980s when his production company got started, and your friend John J. McMahon, who was an executive there, helped bring you into the Carson fold. You had a great story in the book about when Johnny did a special called Johnny Goes Home, and he went back to Norfolk, Nebraska. What do you remember about your trip to Nebraska with Johnny Carson?
The company, the Carson employees, were all staying in the same motel. And the first night we got into town, they were all in the bar, and production started the following day. It was sort of a party atmosphere. They were all ready to go and going to put together one hell of a show. And people got drinking, obviously. And Carson says, another round for my friends. And I said to him, I said, Johnny, I said, it's not such a good idea. Why don't we get out of here? I could smell it. You get a feeling when you're in this situation where you've got a client that you can, intuition, this is not a scene that I want to be a part of, and I don't want any kind of an altercation. It was going to be headlines. I was blessed with an ability to sense trouble, I think. But I said, Johnny, I said, let's get out of here. And he said, no, I want to have another drink. I said, no, we're getting out of here. And there's silence in the room. And he gets up and he says, follow me. And I followed him. And it was a motel atmosphere. There was 30, 40 rooms. And it's double. Two stories. It might have been three. And he'd been given a room, a suite way in the back. And I followed him and followed him and followed him. And he turns around as he gets to his suite. And he says, never, ever, ever, ever talk to me in that tone again. I said, I'm sorry. Good night. Luck would have it, there was a brawl, a fight in the bar after we left.
Now, was Johnny involved in this fight, or
He was in his room, gone to bed.
Okay.
At least I assumed he was gone to bed. I never heard about the bar brawl until the following morning when Jeff Sutzing, is that
name? Johnny's nephew, and he was also a production assistant on the special and would later become a producer on The Tonight Show.
That's right. I awakened the next morning with pounding at the door, and it was Jeff Sutzing. And I was just assuming he was there to tell me that I was fired. And he said, Johnny wants to speak to you immediately. And I said, I'll be there. And I said, where is he? And he said, he's right around the corner in his suite, and he's waiting for you. And so I just assumed I'm going to be fired. You know, you don't talk to Johnny Carson that way. And he asked me to come in. There's suite. Before the door was shut, he said, I want to apologize. I was a total asshole last night. You did the right thing, and I'm sorry. And I'm dumbfounded.
There was an event that he was going to ban you from. He banned you from going to the football game at his high school.
Yeah. That night, he did ban me from the football field or whatever the hell it was. And I said, when all was said and done, and I accepted his apologies and all, I said to him, can I go to the football game with you?
It probably would not have been pleasant because it was autumn in Nebraska and was probably pretty cold at night. How did you come to know Bob Newhart? Was it from being on the golf course?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Golly, I think I represented him 20-some-odd years.
Maybe longer.
Yeah.
What was Bob Newhart like as a client? I've heard that you said he was probably the easiest of all the clients you had. And, of course, Bob Newhart, another member of the Friars Club.
Yeah. He was a good guy, and
I can speak a bit about Newhart. He had a manager who was a gatekeeper type that didn't want Bob doing many things. I mean, and Newhart was a terrific guy. I mean, I had experiences. One example was trying to get him on the Letterman show, and they would love to have had him on the Letterman show. And his manager said, are you kidding? Dave would eat him up. And I said, are you kidding? they revere Bob Newhart. And eventually he did do the Letterman show, and it, you know, Letterman was a huge fan. Any comic would be a huge fan of Bob Newhart's. But we, you know, often ran up against other handlers, and there were conflicts. But Newhart himself was a charming, smart, you know, and gracious guy.
And thankfully still with us. I think he's something like 94 years old now. I know Jenny just very sadly passed away, but yeah, he's a favorite of mine. He's a funny guy indeed.
He keeps popping up on some of the funniest stuff.
Jim, let me ask you, worked with another Fryer, a gentleman by the name of Jack Carter. How did you end up getting assigned to Jack Carter?
I don't know, but his manager wanted me to represent him. And he's a funny guy, but, you know, the Friars, they do these roasts, and it's usually the same group of roasters. A Friars roast wouldn't be a Friars roast without Jack Carter. And he was always placed at the end of the show, the last appearance, the last guest. And they did that, whomever it was that produced the shows. The reason they did it is there's four or five comics before him, and they did nothing but aggravate Jack Carter because he claimed that they were using his material. That it was time for him to go on, and he was in perfect shape. He just prime time because he had all the new material, and he went after the other guests on the program, and he was really a funny guy, but off the wall, so some of the stuff. Not dirty stuff, but, I mean, he berated all these, you know, Jack Benny and these legends. He was a killer. His agent wanted me to represent him. I wouldn't represent him.
That was probably a smart move on your part.
Dad, you did represent him under one condition, didn't you?
You didn't have to talk to him.
That's great. Smart move, I'm sure. Tell me a little bit about Paul Anka. What did you make of Paul Anka? A tremendous talent. And I just saw him in Times Square on New Year's Eve, and he was amazing.
I took him to do the Ed Sullivan show. He was 15 years old. Yeah, I spent the night in his bedroom. A nice family.
Yeah, and you also worked with Tony Bennett, I found out, who we just recently lost.
Yeah. I had some good ones. Vic Damone, Tony Bennett.
What was Tony Bennett like? What kind of a guy was Tony Bennett when you were working with him?
I didn't spend a lot of time with... Unfortunately, I didn't spend enough time with some people, and I spent too much time with...
Jack Carter.
Like Carter, yeah. One client we overlooked that was one of my favorites for a long time was Judy Garland.
Yes, let's talk about Judy Garland before we go. I want to hear, kind of an altercation with her, right?
Only client to ever hit me.
How did that happen that she hit you?
Well, she was going through a bad period and having a falling out with her husband.
Sid Luft?
Sid Luft, yeah. And Guy McElwain, I don't know, you familiar with that name? He ran Columbia Pictures. He worked for me for a couple of years, and he came into my office, and this is during the period when Judy was doing a TV show for CBS, and as luck would have it, Jim Aubrey, who ran CBS at the time, hired me to promote the show, the Judy Garland show, and I was already representing her, so I was double deal on it, you know, it was heaven. So have a client to pay it twice, highly unusual. So Guy McElwain was working for me at the time, and I assigned him the Garland account, among others. And he came in my office, and he said, Judy's been having a serious problem with her husband, and she wants to have a press conference this afternoon and let the world know that she's not a bad mother. And I said, wait a minute, we're not having any press conference any time in the near future. That's out. Forget it. Tell her we're not having a press conference. He said, I've told her that. She won't listen to me. She wants us to set up the press conference, and we'll do it immediately after she tapes a show this afternoon. I said, no, we're not doing a play. So I said, I want to go over to CBS and talk to Judy and put this aside. So I went over to the studio and went to her dressing room. It's all hokey with the yellow brick road from the artist's entrance to her dressing room. And I knocked on the door and there's no answer. And I knock on the door a couple of times and there's no answer. And finally, who's calling? Her. I said, Jim Mahoney, what do you want? Not welcoming me whatsoever. What do you want? I said, I wanted to talk to you about the press conference. She said, have you set it up? And I said, I want to talk to you about it. So I went in. We're not having a press conference. I don't want the world to see you in that kind of a condition. I said, you do a press conference, you're just bringing more attention. Don't you know I'm going to act? Who the hell are you telling me what to do and what not to do? And it got a little worse. And then finally she got up and ran over and pushed me, hit me. Oh. I fell into the couch. And I thought, you know, you just don't get away with this kind of shit. And I got up and I sat there and she started beating at me again. She said, you're fired. And I said, you can't fire me. You never pay me.
Well, so, that's logic.
Fortunately, we never had a press conference. The press got tired of waiting.
I want to point out another interesting tie that you have to the Friars Club before we wrap things up. Your offices were situated across the street from the Beverly Hills Friars Club.
I was a member.
Now, let me ask how you became a member of the Friars. Do you remember?
No. I know that it was so convenient. I literally walked across the street and in the dining room. And the food was always good.
What did you like to order when you were?
Probably salad. You can't screw that up too much.
It's hard to judge the food then. And let me ask you, Jim, after all these years, why do you think that so many of these icons that we've talked about, people who were involved with the Friars Club, why do you think that their mythos still lives on after all this time? And why do you think the public is still fascinated by them and their work?
By the Friars?
By the Friars and by a lot of the people we talked about today.
They had a good press agent.
What a great way to end this. Jim, it's really been a delight. I thank you for making the time. I want to say again, the book Get Mahoney, it is a terrific read, and I highly recommend it to anybody who is interested in the Friars Club and this era of show business, because you represented the best of the best, and you certainly were the best of the best in your trade. And what a delight it's been to hear some of your memories and some of these stories. Thank you again for your time, Jim. It's been an honor and a privilege.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Friars Club podcast. Please be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For more information on the Friars Club, please visit friarsclub.com. We hope to see you there.